You're listening to local and regional news produced by KMUN with help from our news partners. I'm Katie Frankowitz, and I'll soon be joined by my co-host, Skylar Butenchin. There is one very big difference in this morning's news podcast, and that is its length. It is about twice as long as we normally produce, and that's how it's going to be going forward. Yesterday was the last day for NPR programming at KMUN, for now at least. And as of today, we are moving forward with KMUN-produced news hours in the morning and evening. If you want to tune in to listen to those, they will be airing 4 days a week, Monday through Thursday, beginning at 7:59 in the morning and at 4:59 in the evening. There are a lot of things still in flux with these new news hours. We'll be trying some things out over the coming weeks. We'll be trying out some different programming. Please let us know what you think by emailing us at feedback@kmun.org or contacting the KMUN News Department directly at news1@kmun.org. That's news, the numeral 1, at kmun.org. It's Wednesday, October 1st. The news is next. President Donald Trump continues to state that federal troops are needed in Portland. In a speech to military leaders on Tuesday, Trump again likened the city to a war zone. He mentioned speaking with Governor Tina Kotek over the weekend.
And I get a call from the liberal governor. Sir, please don't come in. We don't need you. I said, well, unless they're playing false tapes, this looked like World War II. Your place is burning down.
It's not clear what tapes Trump is watching. However, officials have suggested that Trump may have been confused after watching a recent Fox News report that featured videos of protests from 2020. Trump has ordered 200 National Guard troops to Portland. The state and city are attempting to block the deployment in court. A judge is expected to hear the case Friday.
Two members of the Oregon House of Representatives are pushing for an increase in tsunami and earthquake preparedness funding. KLCC's Zach Ziegler reports.
During a House interim committee hearing this week, Representatives David Gomberg and Paul Evans said Oregon's lack of preparedness showed during July's tsunami advisory. The two Democrats are calling for $300 million in spending over the next decade. Evans says it's hard to keep seismic resiliency well-funded when money could go to schools and health care.
Dollars that we invest in those programs are not dollars we're investing in being ready for the worst natural disaster America will ever have. And it is not hard to count to 250,000 to 300,000 casualties in the first week if we aren't prepared.
Evans said geologists warned that major seismic events happen every 300 years, and it's been roughly that long since the last event. I'm Zach Ziegler reporting.
Some patients are still confused about whether they're eligible for a COVID-19 vaccination. NWPB's Rachel Sun has more on what you need to know.
I'm at Hodgins Drug and Hobby in Moscow, Idaho. Pharmacist Amy Johnston is administering a COVID-19 vaccination.
So relax your arm. Yep, there you go.
Pharmacists say that changing federal guidelines left patients confused about whether they qualify for the COVID vaccine. A federal advisory committee clarified that individuals can make COVID-19 vaccination decisions for themselves. Laura Buchanan, another pharmacist at Hodgins, says even before the update, many younger people did qualify due to certain conditions that can increase the risk of severe illness.
So some of the examples are obvious, things like cancer and lung disease. There's also any type of mental health condition, including things like depression and ADHD.
While pharmacies are allowed to provide the vaccine to anyone who wants one, not all of them do. Most insurance providers are continuing to cover most COVID-19 vaccines, though it's always best to check if you're not sure. In Moscow, Idaho, I'm Rachel Sun.
Razor clam harvesting on Clatsop County beaches opens today, but mussel harvesting is closed from the Washington state border to the city of Florence. The closure comes after officials with the Oregon Department of Agriculture and the Department of Fish and Wildlife discovered paralytic shellfish toxins in recent mussel samples. Matt Hunter, the shellfish project leader with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, says mussels have an affinity for rapidly accumulating the marine biotoxin, more than other animals. Testing sometimes cannot keep pace with how quickly mussels accumulate the toxin. It isn't clear yet if the levels recorded recently represent an upswing or a downswing. Meanwhile, razor clam digs are going forward as planned. Hunter says surveys of the Clatsop Beach area showed a high number of young clams, and as a result, digging could be better in the spring when those clams have grown. For now, he recommends digging selectively, looking for clam shows, the dimples and holes in the sand that reveal the presence of a clam, that are at least the size of a nickel. Diggers can only harvest the first 15 clams they dig up, regardless of size or condition. For the mussels, the wait could be a while. The state will continue testing for shellfish toxins twice per month. In order for mussel harvesting to be reopened, the state will need two consecutive tests showing safe levels. The earliest harvesting could be reopened is at the end of October. Hunter told The Astorian that after an outbreak of paralytic shellfish poisoning last year, they've been on extra high alert. In May 2024, Oregon saw an unprecedented outbreak of the toxin. It sickened more than 40 people and sent some to the hospital. There were shellfish harvesting closures up and down the Oregon and Washington coasts. Together, scientists, volunteers, and tribal partners in the region are working to monitor the harmful algae that caused the outbreak. New state funding could help strengthen those efforts. Olivia Palmer reports.
When Becca Crawford goes out to collect water samples from beaches along Oregon's north coast, she brings a cooler, a pair of waders, and a 5-gallon bucket. On a recent overcast afternoon in July, she pulled up to Sunset Beach outside of Gearhart in a white Jeep, navigating the ruts and the loose sand before parking a few yards away from the incoming tide. Then, slipping out of her rubber boots and into the waders, she ventured into the chilly, calf-deep waves and filled the bucket with water. For her, sampling is a full-day affair.
I started off going south to north today, so my first sampling location was in Cape Mears, which is a little bit south of Tillamook. And then I stopped at Tolovana Park, which is in Cannon Beach. And then right before this, I was at Seaside, and now I'm here.
Crawford is a marine phytoplankton specialist with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. She's also my friend, and I recently asked her to walk me through her work in the field. When she's out sampling, every bucket of water she collects can contain thousands of cells of phytoplankton, a tiny, invisible algae that can have major impacts on human health. Not all phytoplankton are dangerous, but some can produce harmful toxins. And in high enough concentrations, those toxins can accumulate in the meat of shellfish and make people sick.
But in the past, there have been these very sudden algal blooms, which is what you saw in Oregon around Memorial Day weekend last year, that basically take these agencies by surprise, the Washington Department of Health and Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. So we have an early warning system whereby we look at the water in microscopes to see whether harmful species are present.
That's Vera Trainer, director of the Olympic Region Harmful Algal Blooms Partnership, or OrHAB. In Washington, OrHAB works with tribal partners to take water samples and monitor for harmful algae. Meanwhile, in Oregon, researchers like Crawford collaborate with volunteers and tribal partners to take on similar work, collecting samples from 8 different sites, from Warrenton south to Gold Beach. Once Crawford gets her samples, she brings them back to the lab and uses a clicker to count the number of harmful algae she sees under a microscope. Generally, she's looking for a few different kinds of phytoplankton. Pseudonychia is an algae that produces domoic acid, which can cause amnesic shellfish poisoning. If there's enough Pseudonychia in a sample, scientists will use an enzyme-linked immunosorbent assay, or ELISA test, to see how much particulate domoic acid is actually in the water.
And that system is working really well.
But then there's another phytoplankton called Alexandrium. It produces a whole suite of toxins, including saxitoxin, which was responsible for last year's paralytic shellfish poisoning event. Crawford said it can be harder to track, and scientists still haven't developed a reliable ELISA test for it yet.
A wild card is a good way to put it. Because, yeah, loosely, very generally, the way that we're monitoring all of these harmful algae is just going out, collecting samples, and counting them in a sample. And when we see a lot, that's kind of when we can put out the warning that something might be a problem or do further tests to check for toxins. And we have very specific thresholds for Pseudonychia. We don't have that for Alexandrium.
As scientists work to better understand Alexandrium, their monitoring efforts continue to play an important role in protecting human health and informing commercial growers and harvesters. If Crawford sees high levels of Pseudonychia or Alexandrium in her samples, she can give a heads up to the Oregon Department of Agriculture, which typically tests shellfish for toxins every other week.
If you were just relying on the biotoxin data, you would have no reason to expect that in a couple weeks we might see an increase in accumulation of toxin in these shellfish, but by knowing that there had been this shift in the phytoplankton community and that these cells were toxic, we could be prepared and know ahead of time what was to come. And that's really the purpose of the program, is to provide this early alarm system.
Funding is always a concern. Unlike its neighbors to the north and south, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife has historically never received state funding for harmful algal bloom monitoring. Instead, it's relied on a patchwork of grants, starting with a small grant in 2005, and later two different federal grants from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Between those two grants, there was a gap in funding.
And that's just missing data.
But more sustainable funding is right around the corner. The Oregon legislature recently approved the first ever round of state funding for a full-time ODFW phytoplankton specialist and two seasonal staff. Governor Tina Kotek has also signed off. By this time next year, Crawford could have a couple extra sets of hands, helping her provide an early alarm system for the coast, one bucket of water at a time. For The Historian and KMUN, I'm Olivia Palmer, reporting.
Sometimes, a species becomes so rare that you might not know that it still exists. Puffins in the Northwest are that way. Populations of the cute seabirds with the giant schnoz have plummeted since the 1980s, but they're still out there if you know where to look. KUOW's John Ryan caught up with researchers hoping to help these comical-looking birds bounce back.
70 years ago, a biologist named Ernest Booth recorded tufted puffins near Anacortes in Burroughs Bay. He recorded an adult growling and a baby puffin, or puffling, squealing to be fed. That historical audio is from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. 70 years later, I interviewed biologist Peter Hodum on that same bay.
Is this someplace where you might have expected to see puffins?
Absolutely. Historically, puffins were throughout Washington state waters, outer coast of Washington all the way through into the Salish Sea. 50 or 70 years ago, you probably could have seen them a lot more easily.
Hodum studies puffins and other seabirds at the University of Puget Sound.
Most people don't know we have tufted puffins in the state of Washington.
Colonies of tufted puffins used to nest throughout the San Juan Islands. All those colonies are gone now. To see these colorful seabirds, I had to go to the most isolated speck of land in Puget Sound.
I'm on a boat about 5 miles offshore in Puget Sound, and we are approaching the largest colony of puffins left in the Sound.
A bird-watching tour boat is motoring through wispy fog. Naturalist Emily Frost is tour guide for the day.
This is Smith Island. We are looking at the western-facing bluff right here. That is the puffin colony.
The Smith Island Lighthouse has crumbled into the sea. The tiny island is now a hard-to-reach wildlife refuge, off-limits to humans, but welcoming to puffins.
Puffin right off our port side. All of that stuff in the water is bull kelp. This is the largest bull kelp bed in Washington state.
Seabirds like puffins are declining in much of the world. Nearly 1 in 3 seabird species is threatened with extinction. Tufted puffins are endangered in Washington, and researchers aim to boost their sagging populations. On this boat full of diehard birdwatchers, puffins are clearly the star of the show. Dajen Pan of Bellevue is the kind of birder who travels to other continents to add more species to his life list. now up to
1,400 something.
Pan went on the tour to Smith Island just to see a puffin.
It's as good as it gets, I think. Yeah.
As good as it gets?
Yes. That was wonderful.
Washington has lost about 90% of its tufted puffin population. The survivors are easily spooked.
Tufted puffins are, they're divas.
Odom says their colonies are easily disturbed by humans or animals, from rats to rabbits. And declining fish populations leave puffins with less to eat. At Smith Island, the kelp forest that shelters the island and harbors young fish has been declining. Parts of the bluff where puffins nest year after year are eroding. Hodum hopes to find undisturbed bluffs to reintroduce puffins to.
Which islands, if any, might be a good fit for a restoration? We don't want to bring them back into a system that can't support them today.
One trick will be enticing puffins to relocate. They've tried attracting puffins with life-size decoys, and they plan to try playing puffin calls to lure the birds to new habitats. Saving Washington's puffins will require addressing the local threats to their habitats and the global forces, like climate change, that are making the Pacific Ocean less seabird friendly. The hope is that these colorful birds with the big bills can keep being charming little ambassadors for ocean conservation. At Smith Island, I'm John Ryan reporting.
This is KMUN. Candidates running for election in the unincorporated and municipal areas of Washington's Long Beach Peninsula will make their cases to voters at candidate forums this week. The forums are being hosted by the Ocean Park Village Club. People who cannot attend in person can watch the forums over Zoom. The first forum will be held at 6 p.m. today at the Pacific County Fire District No. 1 Fire Hall at 26110 Ridge Avenue in Ocean Park. The forum will include candidates running for commission seats with the Port of Peninsula, the Port of Ilwaco, and the Port of Chinook, as well as candidates in the running for the Pacific County Fire District No. 1 Commission and the Water District Commission. A second forum on Thursday night will also be held at the Fire Hall and will begin at 6 p.m. It will include the candidates running for seats on the Ocean Beach School District Board and the Ocean Beach Hospital Commission. Of the 16 candidates invited to attend, 12 have been confirmed. The candidates who are not able to attend have said they will send statements to be read by the moderator. The Ocean Park Village Club will post Zoom link information to their Facebook page, or people can email opvillageclub@gmail.com for that information. This information comes to us through a news partnership with the Chinook Observer, online at chinookobserver.com. The Oregon Parks and Recreation Department will host a town hall meeting at 3 p.m. this Friday at the Kiwanda Community Center in Pacific City to discuss a proposed setback dike. The dike would replace an existing dike at Sitka Sedge State Natural Area. The State and Tillamook Estuaries Partnership is designing the setback dike to replace the failing tide control function of the existing dike. The town hall is an informational meeting meant to update the community on the progress of that planning as it continues to move forward. The meeting will be live-streamed via webinar and recorded for anyone who cannot attend in person. This information comes to us through a news partnership with the Tillamook Headlight Herald, online at tillamookheadlightherald.com. You're listening to news from KMUN. To hear us on the air, tune in to 91.9 FM. And of course, you can always find local and regional news here at kmun.org. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.